The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Susan Gould and I am a member of the Library Foundation's Development Department. We're happy that so many of you came tonight and braved this wonderful heat and humidity. Our award-winning author lecture series is one of the most popular and longest-running programs the library presents, and it is made possible only through private support. I know some of you here are aware of that and have already made gifts to the foundation, and I want to thank each and every one of you for that. If you haven't done that yet, though, I invite you to consider doing it, and I thank you in advance. Commercial over. I'm particularly pleased to be introducing tonight's lecture. Ruth Shaver has been a good friend of the Free Library for many years, and her accomplishments are inspiring, to say the least. She's founder and president of the Tara Health Foundation, a nonprofit organization that promotes and invests in programs aimed at health, well-being, and opportunities for women and girls. She's also the co-founder and board chair of Rhea Ventures, a group of foundations and investors devoted to reproductive health in the United States. And she was a gynecologist and obstetrician at Kaiser Permanente for 22 years. She was selected for inclusion on the 2020 Forbes Impact 50 list, Investors Seeking Profit, and pushing for change for Ruth's work in impact investing. She's also the founder of the Women's Health Research Institute. Her co-author, Patience Marie-May Ball, has an equally impressive resume. She is the founder and CEO of Women of the World Endowment, an investment nonprofit focused on centralizing women changemakers as economic, environmental, and social changemakers while delivering market rate, risk-adjusted returns, and impact at scale. She has more than two decades of investment experience across capital markets, including debt and equity financing, large-scale infrastructure, and venture stage opportunities, and has led many firsts in the investing space, including developing the Banking on Women platform at the International Finance Corporation, and was also responsible for co-designing its global trade liquidity program. Ruth and Patience will be in conversation tonight with Renee Chenault-Fattah. She is one of Philadelphia's best-known journalists, having served as the evening and weekday news co-anchor at Channel 10 for close to 25 years. But she is also an attorney who practiced law in New York and clerked for a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. She's currently the executive director of Philadelphia Lawyers for Social Equity. Whew, high-powered group, right? I know we're all eager to hear what these ladies have to say. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage. Ladies, come on out. It's all yours.
Thank you, Susan, for that kind introduction. It is so good to see everyone here tonight, to see you in person, to see your faces, to see your bodies, to not just look at that screen with the little chicklet of photographs and avatars. And of course, it's so wonderful to be here with Patience and Ruth. We have a lot of ground to cover in a short period of time, but before we jump into this amazing book, The XX Edge, I'd like for you, Patience, and then you, Ruth, to sort of, I don't know, just take a moment or two and talk to us about sort of the experiences and the background that's brought you to this moment of writing this amazing book.
Well, Renee, thank you very much for doing this with us, being in conversation with us. And I just want to look out and say thank you so very much for being here, everybody. I see, you know, amazing faces, beautiful faces. And you brave the heat and, you know, a bit of COVID, you know, fear to be here with us. So we really, really appreciate that. So my journey, so I hope you're going to buy the book, because there's more of my journey in the book than what I'm going to share here. But there are three things that I'd like to say, sort of three pivotal moments in my life. The first was when I went to do work in South Africa. I was in first year of law school. I thought I was going to be a human rights lawyer. And I went to work at a legal clinic in Durban, South Africa, providing legal services for South Africans, black South Africans who didn't really have access to legal service. And I realized at the end of the 6 weeks, I kept telling people, you have a right to shelter, you have a right to food, you have a right to this. And I realized without economic capacity, they really couldn't access those rights. And it was really important to start thinking about economics. And so the second part of my summer, I went and worked for the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And I realized it was the same thing. Countries that are rich get to do things a little differently from countries that are poor. So economics was really important. I ended up deciding that I was going to do a business degree as well. And so that's the first. The second was the 2008 financial crisis. I was working at the International Finance Corporation, the private sector arm of the World Bank, building power plants and doing all kinds of amazing things around the world, delivering both impact and financial returns. And Lehman Brothers fell. And Christine Lagarde said, if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, things would have been different. And I thought to myself, what would have been different? And really through that crisis, started interrogating what would have been different. And I noticed that for those data was starting to be collected, and companies that are gender diverse teams were actually coming out of the crisis a little quicker. They were faring better. Their stock prices were more stable. And I thought there was something to it, and started building an interest and an expertise in gender diverse investment. And then the third part was in 2018 when I founded Women of the World Endowment. And I love the fact that Women of the World Endowment is really embodies the thesis in this book that gender diverse teams outperform across all kinds of metrics. And I love it because it also brought Ruth into my life. We met 3 years ago, and we've been collaborating since. And so Huawei, I think, is the best part of my journey, is because it brought me to this, and it brought me to us. It brought us to write this book and to you guys.
Thank you, Patience. Ruth.
Well, you'll see that my path was quite different from Patience's, although together we have we cover all of the domains. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, went to Penn Med. I don't know if there's any Penn medical students here, but I think there was an invitation that went out. They probably got scared by COVID. Rightly so.
With reason.
And went off to California for my career as an obstetrician gynecologist. Had a wonderful career at Kaiser Permanente and had the great privilege of being an executive in addition to a clinician. And in my different roles that I had there, I learned about systems engineering and what it takes to change extremely complex systems, and there aren't any systems more complex than healthcare. I also learned in my practice as an obstetrician gynecologist of the power of women as the center, not only as the center of their families and their communities, but that as decision makers, that when we centralized women, that we get, in general, better outcomes. And also a really important part of my journey, my professional journey, was understanding how important family planning was for women, and that when women could have control over the size of their families, that they were able to optimize their social and economic outcomes. So with all of that background in my medical career, I had the good fortune of starting the Tara Health Foundation in 2014. And what's a little bit unusual about Tara Health is that it's a family foundation, and we do typical kind of grant making, but we also pay attention to our investment strategy, and we are 100% mission aligned, which means that across all of our capital, we make sure that we are doing as most we can for our mission, and our mission is improving the lives of women and girls. And when I set out on this journey and I was looking to find out how we could invest better for women, I found that there wasn't a whole lot of information out there. There were some, but we needed to create and we needed to build the field. There were many, many who had been working in this area, and some of you are in the room and some of our colleagues, but there was a lot more that could be done. And that was part of our patience in my journey when we got together 3 years ago, was understanding the system, knowing that we needed to prioritize women in finance, but also that we needed to build the field of impact investing for women. And so I think that's what brought me to this book.
Well, thank you both. Amazing stories. Now that you've done the book, I'd like to do the documentary profiling you two. Just incredible stories. But this book, The XX Edge, I really do believe this is a paradigm shift. In the past, when we've talked about women and investing, usually the focus is on micro-lending or supporting small businesses that impact women. Well, that is not this book. So, Ruth, maybe you could start us off by saying, telling us, sharing, what is the key message here in the XX Edge?
One of the most important messages is that while it's important to do things to benefit all people, not just women, that it's actually about putting women at the center of financial decision making, that women as actors in the financial markets. So, and that is a paradigm shift, and that's what's different about this book from many other books that are in the field. What's also is different is that we've really consolidated all of the evidence across all types of markets. So we looked at public equity, board positions, public companies, women in the C-suite, entrepreneurs, fund managers, all across real estate and all types of ways that women use money. And we hadn't seen that done anywhere else. So that was one of the most important things that I think this book accomplishes. And we also looked at the difference between gender diverse teams and male-only teams. So this is not about men versus women. This is about what happens when there's at least 30% of any kind of financial decision-making body has women on it. And across all asset classes, gender diversity outperformed. Mm-hmm. And then we started thinking about what was the explanation for this? Was it, you know, what would be the rationale or the logic model that would make this happen? And what we saw across all of these different types of areas of investing, that women tend to be more collaborative. Women tend to bring less ego to their decision making. They tend to analyze risk differently than men do. It doesn't mean that they are not willing to take risks, that they do the analysis in different ways. And they're less influenced by social pressures to take risks. And also that women tend to prioritize the long view or long-term outcomes rather than the short-term gains. And while there are many men who have all those qualities, and there are plenty of women who don't have those qualities, I don't mean to imply that these are absolutes. These are just traits that we see show up over and over again. I also want to make sure, and we make this clear in the book too, that gender isn't binary, and we know that. Much of the research, though, that we examined was done with cis women and cis men, and so that was what we had to go with. But that these are traits that show up across all different types of people, and they certainly aren't absolutes.
Yeah. And the beauty of what we did in this book was to really look across, as Ruth said, all asset classes and across the world, actually. This is not a book that's only a Global North book. You will see examples in here, and I always say to people, wherever you're from, if you open this book, you're going to see yourself in the book. In addition to the traits that Ruth just described, we also noticed two things that we call contextual details. The first is that there's a whole lot of really amazing talent that is being left outside of decision-making rooms and innovation rooms and asset allocation rooms. It's amazing how much incredible talent there is out there that could result in differentiated outcomes. And then the other thing that we noticed about women specifically is that they tend to be proximate to these challenges. Mm-hmm. We usually say, and finance loves to say this, that, you know, we need to do all this stuff upstream so we can benefit the victims and the women downstream. And it doesn't think about the fact that you need to bring women into the solution rooms to actually drive the solutions as actors. Because in most cases, they actually are proximate to the issues that we're trying to solve. So let's take the example of the pandemic that we just went through, and we're still going through it. And we think about the, you know, hospital staff that we all applauded at the end of some days. My neighborhood had a you know, can beating thing at the end of days, so we could celebrate, you know, healthcare workers. Well, 70% of healthcare staff around the world are female. Right? These are the people who stood between us and more deaths. But it turns out that in the healthcare space, less than 25% of the leadership is female. And you see these numbers play out in all kinds of sectors, where you have women at the front lines, proximate to the challenges, solving the challenges on a daily basis at the base, but they're not in decision-making rooms and asset allocation rooms. And we lose opportunity, we leave money on the table for differentiated solutions, incredible innovations, when the world doesn't see the point of those who approximate the challenges being in the room. And actually, Renee, you and I had a conversation around this.
Absolutely. Patients, you know, when you talk about proximity and closeness, certainly in the social justice arena, Bryan Stevenson, who wrote Just Mercy, is certainly considered a hero. And, you know, his book, which really is more than a book, it's a movement. And as an aside, I see your book is more than a book, it's a movement. But in Just Mercy, he talks about the importance of being close, mm-hmm. and the importance of proximity, and how the people who are closest to the problems are ultimately the ones to have the answers, the best solutions to affecting change. And that's true in the criminal justice arena, it's true in the social justice arena, and it's certainly, as you've pointed out in this book, the case with women. Absolutely. And why that's a key factor.
Yeah, 100%. Proximity matters.
Yes, it does. Speaking of the book, I want to start off with almost right, I guess in the first few pages, you talk about more pie for everyone. And you quote Milton Friedman, who wrote back in 1980, most economic fallacies derive from the tendency to assume that there is a fixed pie that one party can gain only at the expense of another. So what does more pie mean?
So first of all, let me start with saying that for the longest time, through the months of writing this book was going to be called More Pie. It was Ruth's favorite title for this book.
I'm still very attached to it.
And for a reason, because it really is part of the thesis of this book, that this is not a remove and replace. Let's remove this group of people and replace them with this group of people. It really is about the fact that when we have gender diverse teams making decisions in a room, you are going to get differentiated opportunities that you didn't even realize exist in terms of if you're an investor, what else can you invest in? Well, if there are people who have similar lived journeys in that investment room, in that investment committee meeting, they're likely to see things the same way and not really pick up on the differentiated opportunities that are undervalued that will actually deliver better returns over time. And so what we're saying is with those differentiated voices in the room, you are going to actually end up with outperformance, because you're recognizing opportunities that you'd otherwise not have recognized. You're actually going to grow the pie. And you're going to have better risk mitigation and all kinds of things that grow the pie. And so for us, it was critical to talk about how gender diversity actually grows the pie. So people would not, once again, go into their nervous corners and say, but this means that, you know, there's less for me. We're talking about expansion.
I want to share some statistics, and I know Milton Friedman wasn't talking about this when I say more pie, but when you look at these numbers, it's clear that some people have access to more pie than others. I'm talking about today, 97.8% of allocated investment capital is managed by men. Of the Fortune 500 companies, that number to me is shocking. Every time I read it globally, I'm blown away by that. Of the Fortune 500 companies, only 41 of them are led by women. 41. Just 14% of private equity fund managers are women, and less than 3% of venture capital is directed towards enterprises founded or run by women. So why are more inclusive teams effective in changing those numbers and resulting in a more effective strategy for investing?
Well, I think what those numbers tell us is a huge opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And that if we can start to close those gaps in financial leadership, what does it mean for the economic growth? And there have been a couple studies that we looked at. One came from McKinsey Global Institute and one from the IMF that looked at predictive modeling of what would happen if we could close some of those gaps, not just at the leadership level, like the statistics you said, but throughout the workforce. If we could close some of the gaps in pay equity, for instance, and access to capital. That the prediction is that if we could do that universally around the world, that the GDP could grow by as much as $28 trillion by 2025. And even if you did a more modest analysis and just looked at comparing regionally to the best performance in that region, in sub-Saharan Africa or Europe or North America, that you could grow the economy by as much as $12 trillion. So there's huge opportunity in this lack of leadership. But another thing that sort of is important for us to understand about why this is not a replacement strategy, this is an actual growth strategy, is that we know that, for instance, in the decades before now, that when women entered the workforce, by as much as 20%, that actually the decrease in men in the workforce is only by 1.5%. So that if men and women are not fungible, that there's different skills that women bring to the table that are complementary to men and actually end up truly creating more economic opportunity for everybody. And that's kind of at the macro level, if you think about, you know, at the sort of country level and big business. But we see this played out in some of the research we looked at the micro level. So, for instance, subsistence farmers in sub-Saharan Africa or Asia, that we know that women use capital differently. Even if it's just a tiny little bit of money, they're running their little family farm, that the little bit of capital that they have, they run it more efficiently, and therefore there's more money for their kids to go to school or for their communities. And this, in fact, even at a very local micro level, creates more jobs. And so this difference in how women tend to use capital is actually contributes significantly to this concept of growing the financial pie.
And the returns, speaking to the returns, is also important here. And we looked, as Ruth said, across all asset classes. There's data that showed us that gender-diverse leadership teams are 21% more likely to have outperformance in profitability. We looked at founding teams, and founding teams with at least one female founder are 63% more likely to have a lasting entity created and also a profitable entity. In the hedge fund space, which you think, well, that's, you know, hedge funds is like high finance, right? When you look at hedge funds and you look at average performance, there's a study, we looked at a few studies, but one that looked at hedge fund performance over a six-year period, and you had a 6% margin, greater performance from women portfolio and risk takers than you had from non-gender diverse teams. And I mean, the data in this book just goes on. Women as borrowers, you have lower non-performing assets. Women tend to borrow as much as they can actually pay back. If banks wanted to really watch out over their bottom lines, they would do a lot of lending to the women. But we're not saying don't lend to the guys. Just make sure that you're lending equally to women as well.
That's one of my favorite statistics.
Yeah.
Because historically, women of a certain generation know that there was a long time where if a woman was taking out a loan, she had to have a male cosigner, right? I think it should be the other way around, right? I'm just saying. There was an interesting study that we saw in Chile where they looked at the financial performance, the debt repayment performance in a commercial bank, and that the lenders, the bank managers who were writing the mortgages and writing the loans, were clearly biased towards their male clients.
Yep.
And they did a study that showed that the better performance of their women clients actually, their outperformance would have paid the salaries of all their male bankers. So I'm just saying.
Yeah. There is so much data and so much information in this book. And as you can see, my copy is very dog-eared. With your permission, I'd like to read some excerpts. And then maybe once I get through those,
have you respond to all of them unless something just jumps out at you, and then in that case you say, stop, Renee, I want to comment
better
on that.
Better you read, Renee, because we can write. I'm not a good reader.
I used to be able to read. Not so sure I still can. All right, you say, we are on the threshold of both an economic dislocation and disruption, what we are calling the next economy. Then you talk about the issue of climate. As climate change affects food security, it will drive up food prices. The World Bank estimates that the spike in global food prices since 2008 has pushed 44 million people into poverty in environments where food is scarce. This has heightened the need for an inclusive agenda when looking at how the world will feed its population, and women hold the key. As investors, we can increase our returns by selecting programs that seek to improve food security, that target women who currently have less access, as you've been talking about, to inputs, credit, value chains, and markets, as well as technical advancements related to improving their harvest. And then on the issue of conflict, you don't want to stop me yet? Let me keep going.
No, please go.
Okay. On the issue of conflict, the 2016 Global Peace Index report found that in 2015, the economic impact of all violent conflicts, including war, homicide, incarceration, and police brutality, to the global economy was $13.6 trillion, equivalent to $5 per day for every person on the planet. Women provide a different way of managing conflict. In fact, data shows that including women in peace negotiations resulted in agreements that were 64% less likely to fail and 35% more likely to last at least 15 years. So, with all of that said, if both of you, and I'm not sure who wants to start first on this, but if you could talk about the context we're operating in and the opportunities as well as, of course, the risk.
Yeah, the context of dislocation and disruptions. I think we're all sitting in here and we're all living it, right? Now it's inflationary pressures, it's possible recession, it's absolutely food security. 44 million was, you know, the lovely number at this point, because even more people are going into situations of starvation because of conflict. The Ukrainian-Russian war has resulted in... I was born in Zimbabwe. When you get to read the book, you get that tidbit that I was born in Zimbabwe, and I was listening to BBC News, which is my favorite thing to watch. I should watch your...
No, you shouldn't.
I should.
You're doing just what you need to do.
they actually featured Zimbabwe and what's happening in Zimbabwe, and the fact that there's less food available in Zimbabwe, and they said there's a reduction of 43% of production because of droughts. So it's climate change. It's, you know, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. But my kids are here. My two boys are here. So I would like to speak about the world in an optimistic way rather than the dislocation and disruptions that are coming at us and accelerating at us. And really, at the end of the day, when we say that women hold the key when it comes to climate change, they do, right? Long-term thinking, demand-side climate mitigation is female. Feeding populations, the continent that I come from, 50% of smallholder farmers who hold up the sky in terms of food production, female, and so on. The data is there and it's compelling. We choose not to see it, and when we make decisions not to have women in decision-making rooms, we are making the decision that we do not want to beat back these accelerating challenges that are coming at us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Patience. Ruth.
And the all of the problems that need to be solved, they are material risks to businesses. I mean, obviously, they destabilize governments and they destabilize communities, but they also are incredibly important considerations and risks to enterprise. And so if you're a Fortune 500 company or your multinational company and doing business around the world, you have to take into consideration the global crises and how are you going to respond to them. And whether it's gender-based violence, both in the workplace and in your communities, or lack of access to reproductive health in the United States. These are things that have material impacts on your workforce. And so having women in those rooms to help with the problem solving, the innovation, allocation of capital is really essential.
Mm. And really, if I could just add that what business is used to see as externalities, nothing is external anymore. Mm-hmm. Everything is inside the house. Mm-hmm. And it's not inside the house tomorrow. It's inside the house today. Mm-hmm. And so if you really are thinking about how your business survives, it's, both risk mitigation and, to Ruth's points at the beginning, the traits that we isolated as female, the long view, the risk awareness, the low ego, those traits are really important in the rooms of decision making.
Risk and opportunities. Could you each maybe talk about what you're doing right now? And I want you to start, Ruth, talking about Tara, because there's so much.
There's so much. And so at Tara Health Foundation, we've been in business since 2014. And as I said, our mission is primarily to improve the lives of women and girls. But we've taken a pivot in the past couple years to more robustly integrate racial equity into our programs as well. And so both in our grant making, and we focus on reproductive health and maternal health, particularly the plight of black women in the United States around maternal health. We also look at women in the workplace, and particularly low-wage workers, tip workers. But we spend a lot of energy thinking about our investment portfolio, and we think about the intersection between justice and the capital markets. And one of my favorite quotes from Darren Walker of the Ford Foundation is, "Make the markets work for justice." So when we sit down and think about, okay, what's the levers we can pull as a relatively small foundation to do just that? Reproductive health, lack of capital in new product development. Women are still using the same birth control methods that they used in the 1960s. We've got a lot of innovation in other places. We can make a COVID vaccine in a couple months. What's going on there? So we started a venture fund called RH Capital to bring more money into contraception and maternal health research and development. We also recognize that public companies are our new civil society, that we see all around us that when a company takes a stand, that they often are the ones that drive public policy rather than the other way around. So we've been working for quite a while, sorry to say, we knew this was coming, on helping public companies understand the risks to their businesses around lack of access to reproductive health, and particularly abortion. So things like making sure that companies provide travel vouchers. If they're going to do business in Texas, how are you going to get your workforce that might need abortion care to a qualified provider in another state? We do shareholder work where we show up as a shareholder and make sure that companies understand that if they give political contributions to these candidates that are in fact undermining the stability of their own workforce by passing either their climate deniers and their undermining their policies around decreasing climate change or access to health care in so many of the states of the United States. So that's the kind of work that we're doing in Tara Health and really proud of.
Yeah, the book is just so prescient in making that connection between reproductive health being really health care and the connection to the workforce. Mm-hmm. Couldn't come at a more needed time.
Right. Yeah.
Wowie, which is such a great Women of the World endowment. What's going on right now with Wowie patients?
Thank you for asking that question. So Women of the World Endowment was created to with the idea of really centralizing the role of women in asset allocation. The way my career was in investments, and I knew that being in the decision-making rooms where we decided where capital was going made a difference. And so if women are in asset allocation rooms, I think we will see differentiated portfolios. We'll see a different way of allocating capital to some of the problems, challenges that are accelerating and coming at us. And so I started Women of the World Endowment in 2018, and Ruth was actually one of our, Tara Health Foundation was one of our first donors. And the way we look to drive three things. First, with all of our investments, we are 100% mission-aligned endowment. All of our investments have got to, because money can do more than one thing at the same time. We drive for strong risk-adjusted returns, but also impact returns. And all of it centralizing women as decision makers, as actors, as solution drivers, not as beneficiaries and victims. So we select, we are very thoughtful about selecting the entities that we want to invest in. The second part is we use the knowledge that we are gaining by creating portfolios, constructing portfolios differently to influence other asset owners. And then finally, the income that we generate from that, we on grant it to systems orchestrators that are really doing the tough work of thinking about how we create systems, or how we create systems that centralize women as decision makers, or how we remove friction from this, from the plumbing of capital markets to make sure that capital is reaching the targets. And so we have a number of investments. You know, speaking to conflict, the World Bank just released a study that said if we don't do things differently, 50% of the world's population in 10 years' time will live in a conflict zone. And if we wait another 15 years, 85% of the world's population is going to live in some kind of a conflict zone. Well, that sounds scary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we invest, we're looking at tools. We're looking to also invest in tools. And the investment in tools allows us to be in decision-making rooms even when we're not invited inside them. So I'll speak about one particular investment that we have in our portfolio that allows us to do so much. It's called Ethos ESG. It allows us to say, so Ukraine, you know, Russia goes into Ukraine, we're able to assess our portfolio for, do we hold anything that we don't want to hold? You know, we certainly don't hold military weapons, anything related to climate issues, anything racial justice. We're not just involved as using this as a screen, but we're actually involved as an advisor to them, as an entity that actually helps them think through how all of these things centralize, their decision-making centralizes women. And then, you know, Roe v. Wade, the decision came down, we're able to go to Ethos and say, tell us what's in our portfolio that we shouldn't have right now. So these are the tools that we use. And we've become an investor in Ethos. We use them. We are an investor. We sit on their board. We're influencing them. And it's a little company that's helping us be inside decision-making rooms, really figuring out ways of centralizing women as decision-makers in those decision-making rooms.
Patience.
That's just one.
That flows perfectly into what I guess you would really call the call to action. And I think, Ruth, I heard your daughter say, okay, Mom, what do you want people to do? So whether you are in this room as just an individual, an investor, a manager of a portfolio, what advice, what should people be doing to make an impact? And I think, Patience, you're going to start us off.
Yeah, I'm going to go
you're
first.
You're the investor.
Absolutely.
Okay?
So it's really important to think about, even if you care about climate, and climate only, you care about healthcare and healthcare only, or you care about education and education only, I think it's important to recognize that there's so many knock-on effects. There's intersectionality across all kinds of things that it's no longer okay for an investor to just say, oh, I care about one thing, because there's intersectionality across everything. So I would urge, if you're an investor, think about the intersection of challenges in your portfolio, one. Two, recognize that money can do more than one thing at any given time. So it's not okay to have a values-based portfolio over here and a value-based portfolio over here. Your money can actually do both of those things at any given time. You can invest for value and values. And finally, I think it's really important for investors to think in terms of, you know, what's my capital doing to influence other capital holders? You know, what am I doing? Am I funding data that is used to create products, investable products that make a difference? Think really intentionally about what else your capital is doing. We're doing that every day at Women of the World Endowment, and we'd encourage others to do the same. And the book talks about how all asset owners can actually do that.
There are a lot of investment tips and strategies in the book.
Yeah.
So, Ruth, individual.
And in the last chapter of the book, our call to action, depending upon where you sit in the system, and we all sit somewhere, you may not think that you're in the finance industry, but you are. If you are running a company, you need to think about who you're hiring, who you're promoting. Women aren't as likely to step up for promotions as men are. It just seems to be one of those traits. So if you see in your workforce, whatever size enterprise you work in, think about the women that you think are ready for a promotion. Think about mentoring. We often mentor people who look just like us. And it takes intention to reach out and mentor people who are different. You have to actually work at it. But I'll tell you, it's a two-way exchange that you give so much to when you mentor people who are from a different place than you are, and you learn so much. Certainly investing, and this is obviously if you're a professional investor, but if you're an individual investor, if you just have a retirement account, or you meet with your financial advisor once every year, and things are tough right now, but you can show up and say, hey, I read this great article that says that it's actually one of the simplest ways to improve in performance in my portfolio. If you screen all the fund managers in my portfolio, that makes sure that there's a gender diverse team and at least 30% of those people on that team are women. He or she, most likely he is never going to have heard of that, but then you can hand him the book. You can say, right?
So buy more than one copy.
Yes, you need to buy more than one copy. So there's other things. If you're a consumer, you're an investor because you're investing in the companies that you purchase things from. You can actually do a Google search, women-owned companies near me. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't also go to male-owned companies. I don't mean to imply that there are some great companies out there run by men, but think about it. And certainly voting, that whether you're voting at the local level for school board, you know, the most important thing that people on the school board do is manage a budget. Mm-hmm. And women manage budgets really well. Certainly at the local level, at state level, national level. And you also vote when, you know, if you're a shareholder in companies and you get those proxy statements in the mail and you want to just throw them out, think about it. You know, one of the things about gender is they tend to have names that are more gender aligned, not always. We met Kelly Richards today, the director of the foundation, but and you can always ask, and those are things that now have to be reported in terms of the gender affiliations of board members. So there's a lot you can do, even if you don't think of yourself as an investor.
So much great.
Go ahead. And you can tell your friends.
Right. And it's all in this book. And we're in about 15 minutes, we're going to go upstairs for the book signing. We were very intentional in saving time, and maybe not as much as we wanted, because there's so much information in here. But we did want to save some time for questions from the audience.
Did you explore gender bias from parents at childhood? And it seems like we got to this place for lots of different reasons. And what are the factors among the growth of people that resulted in this?
Interesting. We didn't do that. Why don't you take that? You're the doctor. I'm just
a finance
person. You're the doctor. You take that.
I think all we did was establish that bias exists. We did not explore where it comes from. But you know, we really did write this book for men. And
really?
Really. And some of you are in the room who were our focus group recipients. Everything from the title to the cover. But seriously, that... what we hope to do is appeal to those who already understand the power of women and the value that women bring. They don't need to read the book.
But they should.
They still should. And they should certainly buy the book. But folks who've never thought about it, and those might very well be the ones who have a bias for whatever reason, cultural norms, you know, for whatever reason, that we're hoping that we can appeal to by using data, by using evidence, by using the performance, that it will help to flip. But culture change and you know, the barriers to, it's scary. It's really scary. And men will feel threatened by the, you know, and there we do hear quite a bit of concern about the workforce and certainly, you know, feeling that they will be replaced. And that's really not what this book is about. Yeah. So.
Maybe the best I can do is talk about a little, it's a global nonprofit that Huawei works with. It's called Build On. So they've literally built physical schools, but they also then have ages 6 to 8 attending these schools, but then they have adult literacy programs as well. And what we love about it, and we look, you know, we spend so much time looking around the world for the perfect investments for us. What we love about it is that this entity, everything is 50% female. So when they build the schools, the bricklaying is 50% female. And in villages deep down, deep in rural communities, in cultures that don't see men and women as the same, when a husband gets to see his wife doing exactly the same thing that he's doing, laying bricks, something changes. Cultural norms change. And that goes down to the children. That husband is going to look at those children differently. Now they're not just, the girl children are not just beneficiaries, they're actors. Yeah. And so, you know, that's why I say our money can do more than one thing at any given time if you're intentional about what it is that you're investing in. And that's just a simple story of one of the entities that we are invested in from a grant perspective.
I also want to add that it's not that we are all biased. And certainly women are just as likely to have biases about who should be managing their money as men do. And Patience has a great story, of the venture capital story about the two entrepreneurs. I'll let you tell the story. You tell it so well. And it could just as easily be the women as the men who were making those decisions.
Yeah.
Tell you a story.
So I just told a story about a village, right? There's another story in a high finance investment committee room where they're sitting making decisions about, this is a group that invests in venture funds, and there are two venture fund proposals in front of them. Maybe there were more of them, but these two are specific. The characteristics were the man had built a business, exited a business, and now he had made a ton of money and was building, you know, like most entrepreneurs do now, want to be a venture capitalist. And he was raising additional capital for it. Similar story for the woman. She had built a business, exited business, wanted to now build a venture fund so she could fuel more companies that she knew that she was onto something, knows how to find these specific companies like the one she had built and grow them, similar to the guy. In this investment room, one guy, well, they went through the guy's proposal and they okayed it, they approved it. And when they got to the woman's proposal, one guy said, "Why are we trying to give her money? She already is rich." Right? The guy is a solution driver. He's going to find other companies that they want to fuel. They're going to make money from that. But the woman, she's already rich. She's a beneficiary. Why are we benefiting her more? The idea that women can also be solution drivers and change makers is also alien, not just in that village. And this particular thing that we do is in Haiti. But it happens on Wall Street. And that's what this book is trying to change.
There are some things you didn't put in this book, because in the wee hours you're like, we can't say that. What didn't you put in the book? It was too crazy.
Like, good question.
They'll never hear the logical things we're putting out there if we say this crazy revolutionary thing.
You know what the word that never appears in our book? Equity. I think you believe, that equity will be a byproduct of bringing women into the room as solution builders. This is not about creating equitable workforces. This is bringing the talent into the room, and in order to get them there, you better pay them. So we were really conscious about not using the word equity. And we also really were using power words. Thought about that.
And there's a story that didn't make it, that was my favorite story, that happened because Glenn and I were having a conversation over a breakfast counter, remember? Yes. The story of Odysseus. And how at the end of the day, Odysseus, we all, you know, love the story of the big hero guy, but really Odysseus makes it back to his kingdom because of Athena and Penelope, right? Penelope held the kingdom together, you know, through sort of, I won't find the right word here, but confusing the male suitors that were coming at her. And Athena saved Odysseus' bottom from being killed, and then she's the one who helped him find the way home. But we don't talk about the female heroes. And we don't talk about the gender partnership that happened in that old story, but that happens every day. For some unknown reason, women work in certain spheres, but just not in others, and we don't see the value that they bring to the table. And that's got to change if we're going to have an economy that works for more people.
Yes, clearly what we've been doing isn't working. So yeah. If we're going to change now is the time.
So you didn't make it, that's the story.
But that was a great question. I love that.
Are you aware of any gender diversification studies conducted by Merrill Lynch or BlackRock or a similar entity that hasn't appeared in your book? And what were the results?
We have a representative who knows that study well in the room. It was a great one that came out of Vanguard. And I don't want to embarrass Andy, but you have to correct me if I get it wrong, though. And it's almost good that we didn't have this research before we wrote the book, but so validating. 2,600 active fund managers, they gave each fund a score on gender diversity, in essentially four categories. All female, very, very few all female active fund managers. Gender diverse with more women than men, also very few. Gender diverse but more men than women, and then all male. Most of the funds were all male. And they also stratified by education level and particularly Ivy League education. And what they found that the gender diverse teams that were majority women outperformed.
By a bunch. I think 59 basis points.
59 basis points.
Is it 59 basis
Andy's,
points?
Andy's
somewhere around right there.
Yeah, I think I remember that number.
And the implications are that if you were just going to do one thing in looking at your portfolio, that could potentially give you consistent higher returns. That would be it.
More women.
Did we get it right?
Perfect.
Okay.
But then let me ask you, we got 5 minutes, and I shouldn't be asking, but I'm just so curious about this, because you said you did the study, and gender diverse teams did the best, mm-hmm. but this whole issue of intersectionality, if it is a gender and racially diverse team, do they do even better? Has anybody studied this?
So there will be another book. Ruth might write it, but I'm not going to be a co-author, because I'm
We'll talk about that later.
We know. I think what our book lays out is that diverse teams outperform. Mm-hmm. The data is mostly in the gender space because we've been collecting it for a while. Right. The data on the racial diversity is actually still emerging. And so we couldn't with certainty but say that there's a secret source there. But we can certainly say greater diversity does result in outperformance. And all we have is gender specific.
Right. Okay.
It's another book.
That's the next
Somebody's going to write it and we'll buy it.
Hello, hi. My question is not so technical, but once the two of you met and you realized the vast information that you needed to share with the world and decided to write the book, going from that point to actually getting it published, was it male-dominated, and did you have a hard time to get your book published?
We cheated a little bit. We used...
You could start with the research, hiring the young women who...
So I think that what you're asking is, did we pitch this to traditional publishers in a traditional way where you have to sell it to men who are in the publishing industry, and it didn't go quite like that. We this is a hybrid. We didn't self-publish, but we used Forefront Books and Worth Publishers where we didn't have to sell it to them. Let's just say that. And I was able to finance some of that through Tara Health. So we weren't in the position of having to beg and plead, please take our book. And frankly, if that had been our situation, it might have been a different book because we would have had to make it. And our publicist here is shaking her head. So we had the privilege of being able to write the book we wanted, and here we are. So,
having said that, one of the things that was critical was the fact that we want, the target is really male, a male target. And so we worked with the representative at Forefront and Worth is actually male. We insisted on a male because we wanted his eyes on what we're thinking. We also worked with an interim editor along the way. Ruth and I have two jobs. Ruth is six on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, we wrote this book in 6 months. Wow. And we needed to just be motivated and, you know, there was no downtime. And the guy, we also asked for a guy to work with us. And so, you know, there was male sensibility. We wanted male sensibilities coming through this book as much as possible.
Hey, everyone. I'm Julia Fish. It's so great to be with you. I feel like I've had a virtual friendship with both Ruth and Patience, and I admire both of you. So thank you for making the time. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the role that finance plays in gender equity, closing gender disparities, but I know that finance is but one part. And though we all may feel very frustrated with politics, politics play a role. Policy and regulation plays a role. A New York Times poll just came out the last few weeks that says that young people are disengaged. They want to see younger, more diverse, more female politicians. But young people don't want to get in politics right now, just broadly speaking. However, from the research I've done on gender equity, and I know you all agree, we need regulation to meet certain requirements, and we're seeing a lot of the progress we've made being pushed back. So, like, California State needed to have one woman on every public board. That was just overturned. So, keeping it positive, what in politics and policy is, I guess, most, I don't know if inspiring is too grand a word, but motivating you, and this can be in the U.S. or globally. I'll expand the scope.
In 20 seconds or less.
Well, all right, so we've got the systems map of finance, okay? And you've got supply, all the big asset, you know, BlackRock, the banks that make products. You've got demand down here, which are the asset owners, pension funds, all the endowments,
individuals,
of course, you and me. And then there's the, you know, investable product in the middle, which we think is going to drive all of the deployment of capital that's going to change the world. And then you've got these systems disruptors over here, which are what you're mentioning, public policy, the SEC, compliance, research, litigation. So we have a good friend who's a white guy who said, sue the SEC, because they need, if this is the most important fiduciary thing that anyone can do, because look, it's in the Vanguard article, right? Why the hell aren't they looking at that and anyone who's got a fiduciary responsibility to their client? Oh, interesting, right? So those sorts of solutions could very well be out there. Any of you who have any other brilliant ideas, please throw them into the pot and we'll consider. But that what actually disrupts a system can be things like policy and litigation.
And I think that any one of us can disrupt the system. I think there are a lot of people who think, you know, I've got to grow up to that in order to, if you are working in an organization and you're not seeing what you want to see at the senior levels, I think young people should speak up. And speak up and speak out and cause good trouble.
Speak up, speak out, and go upstairs and buy the book,
that's
right?
Right.
I think we had one more question. You had your hand up. I don't want to leave without answering your question. Sorry.
Hi. Just a quick question. Are there any examples of companies that are doing it right as far as like what you've identified as the right way to do it, or any countries or systems or anybody who's doing it the right way?
Wow. Well, we got Finland.
Well, countries, some of the Nordic countries do it well, and we've got, you know, it's also situation specific, right? During the pandemic, there were certain countries that did it well, and most of them were female-led countries. And that was not us, it's NIH that did the study, and they said, and so it depends. Companies that are doing it well, we feature in our book GPIF, the world's largest asset owner is the Japanese pension fund. And one of the things that they've decided to do is that for all of the asset managers, anyone who does not include some level of gender, you know, analysis is going to get the contract taken away. Because the way they look at it is that's a risk factor that you're not taking into account. And so I would say that we're seeing movement, but nobody's doing it particularly well. But one of the things we want to do is to start this movement. I just said we're seeing movement. That's to start a campaign to bring about change. Every organization could actually do better.
I think it's okay to say movement.
Yeah,
I do. Okay, and I think that's going to have to be the last word, but countries that are doing it well are talked about in the book.
That's right.
And it's upstairs. Patience Mermaid Ball and Ruth Shaber, this has been wonderful. Absolutely. Wow, you made it easy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.